Chapter 27. Free. April 15th, 1945. When I think back on the pain and tortures in the ghetto, the suffering in Majdanek, the fear in Auschwitz, the hunger in Camp Dora and in Bergen-Belsen, it seemed that on that day in April, the world started over again for me and my people. The joy was overwhelming. There were only laughing and crying faces. One would have to be made of stone not to be impressed by those faces, even in our awful surroundings. I added up the sad balance. I had lost my whole family. Father, mother, grandmother, brother, two sisters, brother-in-law, and niece. The way in which all those relatives were torn from me might have been unique, even in that inferno. My dear Hevra, all 12 friends were killed brutally by the Nazi murderers, either individually or in a group as martyrs, along with hundreds of relatives, friends, and acquaintances. On this day, the whole world changed. It was as if a volcano had ceased to spew its lava, sirens had ceased to blare, and a million people stopped to mourn. Suddenly there was quiet and calm. That I am still alive can only be attributed to coincidence and fate. In none of the often precarious situations in which I found myself was I doing anything heroic. Everything I did was a result of either embrera, no choice, or dafka, as an act of defiance. It was a great consolation and satisfaction to me that my friends and I resisted the Nazi murderers with all the available, albeit modest, means. That my Hevra was not able to experience the day of our liberation filled me with sorrow. I can only thank a fortunate fate for allowing me to experience it. There were two things which bolstered my self-confidence and for which I was indebted to good fortune. First, that I never served the Nazis intentionally or voluntarily. Second, that I never acted against my people and my fellow sufferers. I had never been a member, assistant, or employee of Judenrat or the Jewish police, nor had I been a capo, a block or room elder. That was the source of my moral strength. Never during those hard times did I forget where I came from, who I was, and where I belonged. I was always on the side that had it rough, but whose cause was just. Even if I had been able to choose, I would have felt better as one of the persecuted than as a persecutor or an accomplice. As a survivor, perhaps I also made some mistakes and even caused injustices, but my intentions were always good. I fought and resisted with all my limited means. I know that there are many others who experience similar or possibly even worse hardships. I respect and admire all those who engaged in greater resistance against the Nazi butchers. The day of our liberation was one of Cheshbon HaNefesh, soul-searching, for all survivors. At the end of that terrible time, we became aware of how easy it was to show kindness in a normal and free society, though we realized how difficult such behavior had been in the hell of the ghettos and the concentration camps. The diabolical and ingenious extermination apparatus of the SS was especially created to replace the humane with the inhuman, and the good with the bad. Everyone wanted to survive. Many tried at all costs to live better and seem more reputable than the others. Many failed because of their modesty. Some struggled with themselves to the limit of their consciences. It was a hard lesson for everyone, and every character was unmasked facing such an ordeal. Those who survived the test earned a degree in humanism. I could be satisfied with the grade of my own Cheshbon HaNefesh. Whether I actually owe it to my upbringing or my modesty does not have to be asked. For remaining alive, I am indebted to coincidence. In any case, I regarded my own survival as a victory in an otherwise costly war. Like a stranded man among the stranded, like a sufferer bound to all sufferers, I stood alone in the front of the shambles of my life, which had stopped when I was 17 years old, and from which nothing could be salvaged or repaired. My own Holocaust had started almost 5 years before. I was very young then. But in the meantime, I had aged much more than those 5 years. The time of youth, when the basis for a human being is being created, and his personality is formed, the time of cheerful memories, of school, first love, this period of laughter and pranks from which everyone derives pleasure for a lifetime, this period did not exist for me and my contemporaries. It was obliterated from our lives because we were born Jews. We spent this period in a hell among devils in human form. Those years were dead years. No nightmare, no horror story, No fantasy can be compared to life in that inferno. Those 5 years seemed like a lifetime to me. I thought that I had been born and always lived there. Sometimes I would strain my memory to remember the time before 1939. Then my world was comprised only of Jews and non-Jews. I saw the world divided into the persecuted and the persecutors, the tortured and the torturers on the one side, the beaten and the dead on the other, the sadists and murderers. We Jews were always given the role of the persecuted. Even after liberation, I did not dare think of changing roles, although I had wished it before. Just once I wanted to play the other part and then die. The outrageous injustices committed against us hurt us more than all the resulting suffering. I could forgive neither God nor mankind for what I had witnessed and experienced during the extermination of our people. There is a lot of injustice in the world, but for that kind there is no consolation. Like a wounded animal, I thought that I had to show my wounds to the world with its morals, political parties, organizations, and religions, so that not only the crimes of the murderers, but also the rank injustices committed against us Jews would be emphasized. To wake from this trauma, conscious of the necessity to see and judge the world and people differently, to overcome the past was my problem, and that of all my fellow sufferers. Lonely and forgotten by the world, we stood there as liberated newborns and as objects of interest, enduring everything with indifference. Our liberators, the recently assigned helpers and social workers of different organizations, were very good to us. They surrounded us as if they were bystanders who had unintentionally caused an accident and then tried to save the injured. The destiny of Jewish survivors differed completely from that of other nationalities. The rescued people of some countries and nations were transported back to their homes with music and pomp. We Jews were the only ones who had neither home nor family. We did not want to return to our cemeteries, and we did cling to what remained of our Jewish identity. This was facilitated by the representatives of Jewish organizations and the Jewish Brigade from Israel. Attempts by non-Jews after the Nazis' fall to inspire us with pleasant-sounding slogans about the equality of all human beings regardless of race, color, and religion were ineffective and rejected out of hand. We did not care to hear that anymore. The bitter experience of recent history had proved that our 2,000-year-old concerns and problems were and are different from those of others, and that these differences cannot be reconciled. Ours remain specific. We are not to blame for this. After those terrible years of suffering, we Jewish survivors and newborns wanted to live consistently as Jews. The large majority of us wanted to belong to the Jewish community and to live our lives as Jews. Under no circumstances were we willing to wait and rely on the so-called common sense of man, which we felt hardly existed for us. Jewish existence should never again depend on the alleged common sense of man. We Auschwitz survivors did not need, nor did we want, to wait for the Acharit Hayamim, the last days, as the Bible calls them. The role of the eternally weak, pitied and innocent people, which we were forced to play, never did us any good in the past or at present. We came to Auschwitz as weak people. During and after Auschwitz, we realized that this role had to be changed. Only after liberation did we become fully aware of the tragedy in Bergen-Belsen. I was very fortunate to be lodged in the Wehrmacht compound instead of the concentration camp proper. About 50,000 prisoners were gathered at Bergen-Belsen. All of them lived there under intolerable conditions. Every second inmate died within 6 weeks after the liberation, after they had received food, medicine, and care. The English did their best, but they were neither able to cope with that inferno, nor had they been prepared for it. With a great deal of satisfaction, we saw that SS men, our persecutors of yesterday, were forced to bury the dead bodies in mass graves. Only the former functionary inmates were physically able to even consider revenge. That desire among most prisoners, who, like me, weighed about 40 to 50 kilos, was dissipated in the presence of the light, sweet soup that the English gave us to accustom our empty stomachs to meals, normal digestion and functions, and to make us appear human again. About 3 or 4 weeks passed before I could leave the camp for the first time. Close by, I stopped in front of a house. With a slight yearning for revenge, but also with fear, I opened the door and found the house almost entirely empty. Next to the front door, I found a woolen cap that I exchanged for my striped one. I looked for something to eat, but found nothing. In front of the house, however, I saw a cage containing 2 rabbits. If I were not a Jew, I would probably have slaughtered the rabbits and taken the meat with me. I had seen a lot of blood in the previous years, but killing animals was impossible for me. I took an empty sack, slowly opened the cage, and managed to get the 2 rabbits into the sack alive. It must have either been my persuasive words or perhaps a first act of reparation for a Jew that made them jump in. I doubt that they entered because they were hungry, since it was empty. I carried the sack on my back. The rabbits jumped in all directions and were so lively that I almost fell. Nonetheless, I succeeded in getting my booty back to camp. There were about 10 people in the room when I arrived. All of us were hungry, but no one was able to kill the little animals. We opened the sack and set them free. In the days after the liberation, when we realized that there was no Jewish home and family without casualties, and hardly any with survivors, friendships between them developed naturally. Everyone sought to lean on someone, and each of us felt lonely. Thus my friendship with Jacob Hendelis became stronger. Despite the differences in our personalities and views, we moved together into our new lives. We were both tired of the camp and tried to leave, but in 1945, shortly after the war, existence outside was not easy either. Obtaining food and clothing was a big problem. I remember that I went to a cookie factory in Hanover and asked if I could buy some. Of course, nothing was sold at that time. However, I was given a pound box of cookies at the gate. They were a delicacy. I then sent Jacob, and he too received a box. That was a big prize. 1 hour later, we changed jackets and caps, and it worked for a third time. We tried it once more, but by then the game was over. Again, we were able to laugh. I recall how we once got hold of a bicycle on which we rode together to Celle and back. Celle, which was about 20 kilometres away, was the nearest city of any considerable size. From there we often returned with half-filled sacks of turnip peelings from which we brewed our own schnapps. We had learned about this process from a Russian, for a price, of course. The first batch we made was 100% poison. What came after that was basically dirty water, which then was mixed and, according to our Slavic customers, tasted excellent. In any case, it was better than the eau de cologne which they sometimes drank, even if our brew did not smell as good. We sold our schnapps. Our Polish clients made fun of us. Stupid Jews! Here we had vodka, and instead of drinking it ourselves, we were selling it! The Poles thought that we had learned nothing from the war. We had been stupid, and we were still stupid. Our short-lived production presented us with another big advantage. Even without drinking the concoction, we constantly suffered from headaches, and we were always drunk just from inhaling the vapours. On the days following production, we had additional fun getting drunk just by drinking plain water. Anyway, through our brewing talents, we soon came into possession of a motorcycle which caused a great sensation and a lot of noise. The original concentration camp at Bergen-Belsen had been evacuated in the meantime. All inmates, except those who were already in nearby hospitals, were transferred to our Wehrmacht compound. A Jewish administrative committee was organized under the leadership of Josef Rosensaft. Although we had rented a room in Celle, we spent most of our time in the camp. There were also women who had been brought there from other camps. Sometimes it happened that prisoners and SS members with long lists of perpetrations were discovered. Each prisoner who recognized his former tormentor settled his account in his own way on the spot. The same was true for prisoners with outstanding debts. The SS men were fortunate, however, that their methods of punishment could no longer be used. They were lucky that the new democratic, humane laws were first applied to them. We were the last ones to suffer from their murderous tactics. The SS people were surprised, since they knew what they had done and expected the sort of punishment they deserved. One day I read in a newspaper that witnesses were being sought to testify against the SD official Fischer. I volunteered immediately and shortly thereafter was called to Dachau as a witness. I spent 10 days there and was questioned by Allied officers on several occasions. I testified to everything I knew about Fischer in Rajin, Amidzek, and of course I related what I had witnessed in Camp Dora. I told everything I knew about him. Since I realized that a confrontation was bound to occur, I spent many sleepless nights. I still lived in the past, and would now have to face the principal murderer of my family and compatriots. On the other hand, I wanted to know what happened to those special Jews or Sonderjuden to whom he had promised his protection. What happened, for example, to Simon and Angia, who were married before being imprisoned under Fischer's charge? At the time of the investigation, I already knew that no one who relied on him had survived. Only once would I have liked to talk to this creature. I refused to call him a human being, and spit in his face. Perhaps I might even have dirtied my hands and hit him in the face. The day finally came. Accompanied by several officers and guards, I was led into a room in which about 60 SS and other war criminals were lined up in 2 rows. Some were wearing uniforms, others in civilian clothes, but all had shaved heads. As instructed, I started at one corner, took my time, and looked each one straight in the eye for as long as I could. It was actually the first time that I'd ever peered so closely into their eyes. I always considered that the main reason for my survival was due to the fact that I rarely came into direct view of an SS official. I was simply overlooked. Those who had come to their attention were all killed. I walked slowly from one to the other, looking for the one murderer among the many. I had almost finished one row when I began to doubt whether I would recognize him. Could I tolerate listening to one word of his on Jews who were beaten to death under his command? Suddenly I recognized the last one in the row. It was Fisher. I needed all my strength to point him out. But I did not question him, nor did I spit in his face as I had planned. I saw him for one fleeting second, through a fog, and then I blacked out. I woke on a couch in an adjoining room. Later I learned that Fisher was extradited to Poland and as an SS criminal. Mayor Turkeltaub, a cousin of mine, testified against Fisher at the trial. When I returned to Bergen-Belsen after my testimony, I felt a great sense of relief. The following weeks and months remain in my memory not only as a period overshadowed by a sad past, but also as one absolutely free of worries and concerns about the future. As if recovering from a serious disease, we lived in convalescence with free housing in the Bergen-Belsen compound and received free food from the Joint Distribution Committee in America. Slowly we returned to human culture. We remembered music, theater, and books. The opposite sexes attracted each other again. Sexual life was revived, and soon marriages were performed in abundance. My friend Jacob and I alternated between living in the city of Celle and Bergen-Belsen. We befriended two sisters, Dora and Bala, and spent a great deal of time with them. Dora was usually at Jacob's side and Bala at mine. Our friendships flourished. At that time, I could not imagine marrying a woman who had not shared my experience. I was there grateful that Bala had traveled the same roads as I had, including the journey from Auschwitz, and shared the same experience of liberation on the same date in Bergen-Belsen. We were married in 1946 in Marburg. My friend Jacob became my brother-in-law when he married Dora. After the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, when we went for walks there, we were often stopped by former prisoners who thanked and kissed Bala for the help she had rendered at the risk of her life in the camp. During a bus trip to Hanover, a woman recognized Bala, threw her arms around her, and thanked her for saving her life. That was a very proud and moving moment for me. We experienced a similar incident in New York some years later. My wife has often told me that she is indebted to her sister Dora for saving her life. My children and I are eternally grateful to her. At that time, we lived in a classless society. We all possessed the same, nothing, ate the same food, wore the same clothes, and experienced the same concerns, joys, and goals. Socially and in all other areas, equality, comradeship, helpfulness, and harmony prevailed. It was life on equal terms. A community that had died was resuscitated. This time of transition was soon superseded by a new and brighter period. As if by the signal of a starting gun, the race for money and for what one could do with it had started. Again, everyone wanted to amass more wealth and achieve more than their friends and neighbors. Was that a sign of the return of normality? I do not know. In any case, Bergen-Belsen soon became a base for a flourishing black market in which the majority participated. The incentive for this change came from Jews arriving from Russia, for whom this type of business was an integral part of their very struggle for survival. If we had been transferred to Israel before or during this period, we could have served ourselves in Israel well. Although we were skeptical and suspicious, we were consistent, willing to adapt, and prepared for any new beginning.